Luke 20:17. The words here concerning a stumbling stone concern the building of Solomon's temple. As they laid the foundation for that temple, they had a stone that seemed to be in their way. They tried to fit it in various places and it wouldn't fit. So they cast it aside and it lay around for weeks and months in their way. And finally, when they came to look for the cornerstone for the building, they tried every stone they could find. None would fit and none would stand the tests. And finally, they went to this stone that Christ speaks about here in Luke 20:17. And he beheld them and said, "What is this then that is written? The stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner." The stone they'd cast aside as of no value was the only one found appropriate for the temple. The rejected stone became the most important stone in the entire building. But it still was a rejected stone. Paul and Peter call it a rock of offense, a stone that caused us to stumble. Without using the symbolism of stone, Paul discusses this in 1 Corinthians 1:23. He leaves out the idea of the stone here, but discusses the same thought. 1:23 of 1 Corinthians. "But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, unto the Greeks foolishness." And Paul in Galatians 5:11 talks about the offense of the cross. The offense of the cross. In many, many ways, the Bible speaks of Jesus as being offensive. We often do not think of him that way. But that last night he spent with his disciples in Matthew 26:31, he warned them in advance that something was going to happen. In these words, he said, "Then saith Jesus unto them," Matthew 26:31, "all ye shall be offended because of me this night." Talking to his most intimate friends, his disciples, "all of you shall be offended because of me this night. For it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad." If you read on in that chapter, verse 56, the last part, Matthew 26:56, "Then all the disciples forsook him and fled." They didn't leave him only because of the danger. That was one cause. It was embarrassing to be identified with Jesus. It was. When you're on trial before the head of the Sanhedrin, the high priest, you are an offshoot, you are an imposter, you are a false Christ. You were starting some kind of a revolution, King of the Jews. When you would hang on a cross, you were branded as the worst of all criminals. It was time to leave Jesus. And they left him, all of them. "All of you shall be offended because of me." Are you better than they were? Am I better than they were? If all of them were offended, is it possible that all of us can be offended and then forsake him and flee? They all did. The Bible says so. They're all offended and they all forsook him and fled. It wasn't very popular to stay near to Jesus. In addition to the trial and crucifixion of Christ, there are many things about him that are offensive and embarrassing to proud human beings, and even to professing Christians. We often don't see it this way, but he is frequently like a stone that gets in your way and you fall over him. Frequently. Until finally you get so angry at stumbling over this obstacle that you blame the stone and you turn around and want to give it a kick like a spoiled child. You ever done that? Don't blame yourself, but you blame him. And today, we like to blame Jesus sometimes for our problems. Of him, a prophet predicted, the gospel prophet in Isaiah 53:3, in a verse that we sing about, frequently, but seldom does it penetrate our thoughts. 53:3 of Isaiah. He is despised and rejected of men. We are humans, are we not? He is despised and rejected of men. The last part of the verse, he was despised and we esteemed him not. There was nothing in him to place him very high in our estimation. We esteemed him not. All will be offended because of me. This was true throughout his whole life. You start back about his birth. He was born in a barn in modern English, not a stable. A stable is one of those antique words we dressed up, you know, sort of a renovated barn, so it looks so beautiful and spotless and pure, you know. We have some imagination like that. It was a cow shed in some people's language, or a horse barn, however you wish to put it, or a place for sheep, but not a place for humans. When you look at his birth, it becomes more unpleasant still than just the birthplace. In Matthew chapter 1 and verses 18 and 19, it's suggested that he was born of illegitimate parents and conceived that way. Matthew 1, 18 and 19. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise, in this manner. When as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man, not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. You understand what these words mean, don't you? The Jews did. In John chapter 8 and verse 41, they reminded him of his birth, that he couldn't brag about his parentage. John chapter 8 and verse 41, he was discussing with them about their parentage, that they were really not of Abraham as they professed to be. You do the deeds of your father. Then they said to him, we be not born of fornication. We have one father, even God. We be not born of fornication. Of whom did they refer to? Jesus. You know, you can talk about fathers and parents, but we know who our parents are. Who are yours? And so the story had gone around about him, you know, not just the place he was born, but the circumstances. Would you like to have been born under those circumstances? Would you brag about your parents if you had been? Then he grew up in Nazareth. One of his disciples, Nathanael, said, can any good thing come out of that place? In John 1:46. Is there anything good over there at all? And that was his home for 30 years of his life. So he began to compound the problems, you see, and the environment and circumstances under which Jesus lived. He was not a professional man. As many would say today in this city, he was just a carpenter. Met a man a couple years ago who I had not seen before. We talked together and I said, and what is your work? And he said, oh, I'm just a farmer. Just a farmer. I think he had over 1,000 acres, but he's just a farmer. He had enough land to send his kids through medical school, but he is still just a farmer. You know, sometimes our value systems are very perverted. We forget how we get through some of these places and by whose occupation we have the money to go through. He was just a carpenter of poor peasant parents. Even as an adult, we're told, he was still poverty-stricken. In Matthew 8:20, as in our Sabbath school lesson, foxes have holes and the birds there have nests, but the Son of Man doesn't even have a place to put his head down. Not at all. This was the one that we call Christ. According to the Bible, he had no formal education. John 7:15. John 7:15. The Jews marveled, saying, how knoweth this man letters, having never learned? He's never gone to school. You're embarrassed if you haven't finished the 8th grade. He didn't finish the 1st grade. And there were educated people in those days, very well educated. Apostle Paul probably had gone to school all of his life, practically, formal education. But this man seemed to have wisdom, but they couldn't understand why he'd never attended school. His disciples that he gathered around him were in the same fix as he was, Acts chapter 4, verse 13. Acts 4:13. Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John, and perceived that they were unlearned and ignorant men, they marveled. Perceived they were unlearned and ignorant men. Do you like those terms attached to your name? If there's one thing that makes people shrivel up in this town, it's to be called ignorant or unschooled. We immediately run to some degree mill to get something behind our names to make sure they can't call us ignorant again, you know? Or we put on some sophisticated speech so they think we're educated or something other, you know? Anything to avoid the tag ignorant. That just really hits us in the solar plexus, doesn't it? We can't bear to be called ignorant. But all of the disciples, unlearned, ignorant. Can you think of worse terms than that? And they're out teaching the world. Sent out to be teachers to all the world, these unlearned, ignorant men. Never even heard of a seminary. He was also friendly with people like Samaritans, Syrophoenicians, whom the Jews called dogs. Now, if you're worried about your reputation, you never talk to those people. His disciples didn't. He did. Perhaps for hours. He doesn't say how long. At one time, he stayed at the home and ate at the home of a man who had the worst reputation in all of the Holy Land, Zacchaeus. Nobody liked a tax collector. These men were thieves, and it was made legitimate by the laws of the land. They could extract from much of you as your purse would allow. You'd love them, wouldn't you? And here was a man who was the leader of the mafia, you see. And Jesus went to his house. You know, he stayed there, but he ate there. Not until he lived in the countries where you are contaminated by eating in certain houses. Do you understand what that means? But he ate there and he stayed there. And he liked to go there. He said of himself in Matthew 21:31, that he had certain people that are more prone to follow him than others. They weren't exactly the kind that would enhance his reputation. Matthew 21:31. And just the last part of that verse. Verily I say unto you that the publicans and the harlots go into the kingdom of God before you. You know, if your followers were publicans and harlots, would you brag about your disciples? The leaders of the country didn't follow him. They rejected him. It was this class of people that clustered around him very readily. The others turned away. Upon at least one occasion, he defended a woman who was taken in the very act of adultery, something that was very much frowned upon by the Jews. You can read about it in John 8:3-11. I'll not take time to read all those verses. He frequently stayed at the home of a woman who was devil-possessed. In fact, that was his special place to stay. She seemed to be the most devoted follower of all that family. Luke 8:2, and you know who it is by now. This was the home of Mary Magdalene and Martha and Lazarus, out of whom he'd cast seven devils, the Bible says. Luke 8:2. He often disagreed with the religious leaders of his day, very much like disagreeing with General Conference President and all of our leaders and Billy Graham and other religious leaders, very much like that. And he openly and flagrantly disagreed with them. And he went beyond the disagreement. He even pronounced woes upon them in Matthew 23:13-36. Almost every other verse is a new woe, a new curse on these religious leaders. How would you like to say, cursed be the General Conference President for so-and-so, you know, woe unto you. And they'd say, who do you think you are? This is a way to win friends and influence people, isn't it? Pronounce curses on them all. And a long line of them. There in Matthew 23. Strange things. He committed acts that made him very, very unpopular and looked upon with disfavor by the leaders, such as kicking them out of their own temple. I mean to say it that way, you know, they've looked upon as their own temple. But on two occasions, he cleansed the temple and drove them out. Made my father's house a den of thieves. You know, that's a nice way to get along with people, isn't it? And to hobnob with the leaders of your day. He frequently violated their traditions, their customs. Matthew 15, verse 2 talks about this. When they came to him and said, "Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread." We're still, they're eating on the Sabbath as they went through the fields and got this food, you see. And Christ over and over again violated traditions and customs as though nothing was sacred to him. I'm sure they would say, use those words. And on occasion, he violated their laws concerning the Sabbath. To begin to get the flavor, the environment around Jesus, you can just go on and on with this trend that I'm talking about here. When he became popular among the people and they desired to make him king in John 6:15, he fled away from them. John 6:15, let's read it, shall we? When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. But they were not so easily rebuffed, so the next day they find him on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And as they found him over, they came to him, verses 25 and 26. When they had found him on the other side of the sea, they said unto him, "Rabbi, when camest thou hither?" Now, you'd be very happy if people were chasing you, wouldn't you, and following you because you're so popular? Listen to his words, which seem like a rebuke. He answered them and said, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat the loaves and were filled. You just want me to keep on feeding you, you won't have to work the rest of your lives." And here they want to make him king. You know, they could start a popular action in the community, and finally this whole huge crowd, getting all their neighbors and friends, would put him on the throne. Isn't that what you like as a Seventh-day Adventist? Wouldn't that be wonderful if a Seventh-day Adventist became president of the United States? By popular action of all the people, popular demand, you know. I cannot avoid doing what they want me to do. They've made me the president, I must be president. You've heard those political speeches, you know. Christ disappeared from their midst and then rebuked them. In other words, every time he seemed to have success, he'd run away and didn't seem to want us at all. Many of his teachings were the most negative you can find any place, critical and unsavory. Read with me Luke 6, verses 24 to 26 to see how negative some people can be. And I don't wish to be critical. Luke 6, 24 to 26. "But woe unto you that are rich." That's guaranteed to win friends, isn't it? "Woe unto you that are rich, for you have received your consolation." All the satisfaction you're going to get in rewards are here. You'll get nothing over there. That's what he's saying. "Woe unto you that are full." All you Americans have so much to eat. "Woe unto you. Cursed are you. You're going to get terribly hungry." Doesn't that make you happy? Doesn't that make you jump up and say, "This is the man I've been waiting to hear for a long time"? "Woe unto you that are full. Woe unto you that laugh now." I thought we're supposed to be happy. He pronounces a woe unto those that laugh now. Why? Said, "Ye shall mourn and weep." Aren't those nice teachings? Aren't they pleasant? They go down about this far, don't they? And you start choking and coughing. And you somehow can't get it out. These are the teachings of Christ. "Woe unto you when all men shall speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets." They hated the true prophets and they loved the false prophets. When everyone's saying, "You're wonderful church, you're wonderful people, you're a great preacher, woe unto you." But that's exactly what we're fighting for today. We want all men to speak well of Adventists. The Methodists the same way. The Catholics the same way. The Pentecostals the same way. Go any place. They all want everyone to speak well of them. Jesus said, "Woe unto you when this happens." That's what they do to false prophets. Isn't that nice? This whole chapter is filled with unsavory teachings like this. Verses 27 to 30. "Love your enemies. Do good to them which hate you. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them which despitefully use you," and so on. "They smite you in one cheek, tell, hit me over here. You know, take away your cloak, tell them to take your coat. Give to everyone that asks of you. If they take something away from you, don't ask them for it again. Just read it. That's what it says. This was Christ's most prominent sermon, his very first sermon. I could take time to read the rest, and you'd find it's the same way. When a rich man came to him who wanted to have some success and wanted to be perfect in life, he said, give everything away to the poor. Everything. And he said, goody, goody, I've been waiting for someone to tell me how to do it. Here it is. Is that what you'd say? I'm so delighted that someone has told me, all I have to do is give everything away and everything's fine. And you're glad to get rid of everything, aren't you? That's the teaching of Christ. It's been there for centuries. Now, to climax this whole experience of Jesus, he was crucified on a cross as a common criminal or a worse criminal. And this is the one who claimed to be God. Their God died. He was punished for sin. Weak human beings took him a prisoner and tried him and killed him. Can your God die? Does God suffer? Your concept of God? Is God punishable? You understand? This is the Christ that Peter called a stone of stumbling, a rock of offense. Do you know what we've done to this? We've bypassed these things. We've neglected them. We've rejected them. We put them out of our thoughts. We've invented another Christ that is more savory. But he's not the Christ of the four Gospels. He's not the Christ that the Apostle Paul knew, and he's not the Christ that the Apostle Peter knew. Not a bit. The Christ we often talk about today, you can't find in the Bible. He isn't there. You see, this Jesus, who's a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, is very contrary to self. Very offensive to self. And self wars against him, back and forth. We don't like this. We say, can't you make it easier? Can't you make it nicer? Can't you make it more palatable, more savory? Does it have to be like this? I don't like it. You can read in the Bible in Galatians 5:17 how there's a war between the flesh and the spirit, between self and God. And they struggle against each other. You can read how there's a war against the world, which we love so much, and God. They're mortal enemies. Read James 4, verse 4, and John 17:14. There's a fight. Now, may I suggest to you that we can never make the unpopular popular? Never. For years and years and years, we thought that PR was a Christian principle. We sat on committees and we said, but it will give us good PR. It must be right. And immediately everyone's in favor because good PR. Friends, that was not like Jesus. That was never like Jesus. If he were concerned about PR, he would never pronounce one woe on the Pharisees. He would never have disagreed with religious leaders at all. Never. He'd never been born in that place of those parents and grew up in Nazareth. Never. He'd be irrational to do that. PR was not an overriding principle of him. It was not there. And friends, we have damaged Christianity and perverted our Christ in believing that PR is the way of Christ. There is a PR that can be Christian, I understand that. But the PR we often use is something else. And may I suggest that we will never make Christianity popular. Never. Not the real article. We can invent a Christianity and a Christ that will be popular. But this will degrade the true Christ and pervert it. It will be a misrepresentation of him, for you cannot make him popular. The one who said, if you deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me, you can be my disciple. You can't make that popular, for it doesn't satisfy self, and it never will satisfy self. Somehow, in thousands of ways, we've demonstrated unbelief in the Christ who is a rock of offense. And we believe we're right. Now, this rock of offense is a contradictory symbol in the Bible. It says such opposites so frequently. This life of Jesus that appears unpopular, it appears negative, it appears distasteful. Can any good thing come out of a lifestyle like that? Can it be productive of good? Christianity says yes. Most people can't believe it. After all, he ended up on the cross dead. If you go back to Peter, where we're reading, 1 Peter chapter 2, you will find some interesting things there about the future of this one who is so offensive, the rock of offense. Verse 7 of 1 Peter chapter 2. It says, the stone which the builders disallowed, back in Luke 20, which they rejected, this despised, this forsaken one, this one not esteemed, this offensive one, that stone, the same as made the head of the corner. When they built Solomon's temple, he became the most prominent stone in the building. He was the stone. All the others were insignificant. All the others were not rejected. A place was found for them immediately. This one that was rejected for so long became the most prominent stone, the headstone, the cornerstone. That's the prophecy. The same prophecy is found in Matthew 21:42 in the words of Jesus, and we ought to read that. And it's also found in Isaiah 28:16, if you'd like to read that when you have time. Matthew 21:42. Did you never read in the scriptures Christ asked, the stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner. This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. It's an amazing thing that this person has suffered so much self-denial, so much despite, so much rejection. This person is so offensive to human beings. He has become the most prominent. This is the Lord's doing, Jesus said, and it's marvelous in our eyes. We're amazed at it. How can you understand what this means? How can a life that ends as Christ did on a cross finally triumph? How can he become the most prominent, productive of good? Christ tried to explain it in Matthew 16, 24 and 25. Matthew 16, verses 24 and 5. Then said Jesus unto his disciples, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Now the next verse. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. And whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. If you try to enhance yourself and make something of yourself, you will lose everlasting life. If you lose yourself, you will find everlasting life. Now, this is not clearly explained. If you go back to 1 Peter 2 about that rock, you begin to find out what Jesus means about this verse. In 1 Peter chapter 2, and now we want to read verses 3 and 4, the verses that preceded those we began our study in today. 1 Peter 2 and verses 3 and 4. If so be ye have tasted that the Lord is gracious, to whom coming? To coming to the Lord, in other words, as unto a living stone, disallowed or rejected indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious. He said this rejected stone, this offensive rock, is a living stone. It's not just a lifeless rock. It's a living stone. And as you read verse 5, it says, when you come to him, building on him, ye also then, as lively or living stones in other translations, are built up a spiritual house. When you as Christians come to this Christ, this rock of offense, and build on him, you also become a living stone, such as he is, referring back to our study of 2 or 3 weeks ago. In Desire of Ages, page 599, it discusses this living stone and coming to him. By connection with Christ, the living stone, All who build upon this foundation become living stones. As I connect to Him and build on Him as a living stone, all who build upon Him become living stones like He is. Many persons are, by their own endeavors, hewn, polished, and beautified. In other words, they become refined, cultured, sophisticated by their own efforts. Many, by their own efforts, have become hewn, polished, and beautified, but they cannot become living stones. Why? Because they are not connected with Christ. So we can make ourselves look good, you see, but we have no life. None at all. We are not connected with Christ. Without this connection, no man can be saved. Without the life of Christ in us, we cannot withstand the storms of temptation. See, the rock stands always. It's not built on sinking sand. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. So it can withstand temptation, you see. We cannot, because we're not built on Him. Our eternal safety depends upon our building upon the sure foundation. So now I become a living stone, life in me, as I build on Christ the living stone. I can polish and make myself look very beautiful and attractive to other humans. But unless I build on Christ, there's no life in me. I'm a dead stone, as dead as all the other stones round about us. It's a law of nature that by dying, we live. It's a law of nature, and you can't violate it, that by dying, we live. Christ discussed it in John chapter 12, verses 24 and 25. John 12. Now, this is the application of all this about the rock of offense. John 12, 24 and 5. Verily, verily, truly, truly, I say unto you, except a corn or kernel of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abide alone. Unless that seed dies, it'll abide alone. Nothing comes out of it, you see. But if it die, it brings forth much fruit. It lives again. Then he makes his application. He that loveth his life shall lose it. He that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. The one who loves his life and tries to enhance self will lose life, you see. He that hates his life and dies, you see, to self, will keep it unto life eternal. These contradictions of Jesus are so meaningful. All I do to build up self will kill me. Over and over again, it'll destroy me. And all I do to deny self will give me life. And life eternal. And Christ is teaching that. If you go back to Desire of Ages, the very first chapter, and you must read those pages again and again and again. I've referred to them in the past, I'll refer to them again. Pages 20 and 21, Desire of Ages. In the light from Calvary, it'll be seen that the law of self-renouncing love is the law of life for earth and heaven. The law of self-renouncing love, the light from Calvary where Jesus denied himself to die, is the law of life. As he was failing so far as self was concerned, as has been crucified as the worst of criminals, he was living again and giving life to every human being. In the failure of Christ, there was alarming success. There really was. The rock that's rejected becomes the most prominent, the chief cornerstone. In the dying to self, the self-denial, there is life. It continues on page 21 of Desire of Ages. Looking unto Jesus, we see that it's the glory of our God to give. In these words is set forth the great principle, which is the law of life for the universe. To give, you see, to think of others, to forget self, to always be giving, not receiving. Nature does this, heaven does this, God does this, Jesus did this. Forgetful of self, always giving to us, is the law of life for the universe. Down at the bottom of the page it says, sin originated in self-seeking. And James says that sin bringeth forth what? Death. Sin originated in self-seeking. Self-seeking is death. Self-denial is life. Receiving is death. Giving is life. as Christ walked about this earth, a very unpopular person, despised and rejected of men, esteemed him not. As he appeared offensive in his unpopular teachings, in his breaking of customs and traditions, one thing was happening. Christ was not living unto himself. Self was dying every day in Jesus. He never allowed himself to become prominent. Why not? Self would grow. He would not be our example for life. Not at all. And Jesus kept his body under day after day after day after day. And he said unto us, I am the way, my lifestyle, the truth, and the what? And the life. And it's not a life, the life. There's no other. This is the way. This is the way to life eternal. There's no other. This is the way. Walk ye in it, he bids us. If you'll live, he said, lose your life for others. If you'll die, take everything to yourself. These are the laws of nature. When you go back and look at that life of Jesus, that seems so obnoxious to proud human beings who are always egocentric, aren't we? Always. The great danger, as you know, is that self will become so big. That's the danger. We fear self-rejection, rejection by others. We fear poverty. We fear all the things that will give us life eternal. And we crave and are obsessed with all the things that will destroy us. Literally. And Christ came along and lived an opposite life. And it conflicts with selfish humanity. Jesus said, if any man will come after me, let him take up his cross. Deny himself. Follow me. If you lose your life, you'll find it. If you seek to save your life, you'll lose it. May I close with the words of Christ, Matthew 21:42. The stone which the builders rejected, that despised one, he, the same one, has become the head of the corner, the most prominent one. This, he said, is the Lord's doing. And it's marvelous in our eyes. Friends, when you see Jesus in his self-denial, in his offensive nature to our selfishness, when you follow him down his lifestyle pathway, when you hear that still small voice saying, this is the way, walk ye in it, and you take hold of his hand, he takes hold of yours. There are many, many difficulties. And our hearts will cry out, you know, oh, satisfy self. And as we suffer with Christ, Paul says we shall what? Live with him. For self is dying, and Christ is becoming all in all. I don't expect this to make you happy. I don't expect it to make you popular. Christ was not trying to win a popularity contest. He was trying to give us life. This is the way of life. May God grant that we'll learn to love the one whom the Bible calls the rock of offense. Thank you so much.